This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Joined on the Legal Curve Hockey Show Saturday Spotlight, the sixth edition of Saturday Spotlight, by Kerry Fraser, former NHL official and current TSN analyst and writer of the Come On Ref blog on TSN.ca. Kerry, thanks very much for joining me today.
Hey, it's a pleasure, Richard.
You know, Kerry, I want to go over kind of like a retrospective of your career and talk about a bunch of things both in the past and looking forward. I want to go back to, and I want to make sure I have my facts right, I believe I read that you started skating at 15 months old. Is that correct?
That's correct. My father was playing minor professional hockey in the International Hockey League at the time, and as soon as I could walk, he slapped a pair of skates on me and would take me to practice. Before the players went on, the trainer would put my skates on, and I would go out and push a chair around. So it became natural for me, more natural than walking.
And then you got into officiating at 12 years old?
Well, I was playing minor hockey in the AAA All-Star system of Sarnia, and my father was doing some officiating Industrial League hockey. And so in order for me to get some extra skating in, he would take me along, and I would skate and pick up the puck and bring it back to him or conduct a face-off. So it was really under the guise of me getting some extra ice time.
And it's interesting, and you mentioned playing hockey in Sarnia. You were a pretty good player by my research.
Well, I was a good little player. I played to the Junior A level. I was the captain of the Sarnia Bees in the Southern Ontario Junior A League, finished in 1972. But a lot of my teammates through minor hockey and junior went on to play in the NHL, and fortunately for me, I chose a different path, knowing my limited abilities and size.
Interesting. And those guys, how many of them did you come across then when you became an official?
Well, a number of them. You know, Wayne Merrick was a teammate of mine. He won four Stanley Cups with the New York Islanders. Bob Neely was first-round draft pick of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Jerry Butler was drafted by St. Louis and also played for the New York Rangers. So there was quite a few of them. Sarnia was a hockey hotbed at that time, and a lot of fine talent came out of that small community.
And your mentor growing up, or at least one of them, was John McCauley. How did he affect your career?
Well, John, when I decided that playing was not going to work for me, I went to a referee school in 1972, which was my final year of junior hockey, and that late August, I attended a five-day referee school in Haliburton, Ontario, and John was one of the instructors, along with Bill Friday and Vern Buffy and John D'Amico, another Hall of Fame official, along with others. And John, I was scouted at the camp, and 2 days later, I found myself being invited by Frank Edveri to the NHL training camp for officials. So the transition for me was very quick. I didn't have the experience of minor hockey officiating. I went right from playing junior to the NHL training camp, and I got that first season to work a number of games as a linesman in the American Hockey League. And I traveled. It was one of the first times I got on an airplane to fly anywhere, and I was traveling all over. And John McCauley was a referee that was doing games in that league, and we traveled a lot together, and I got to see how he interacted with players. He had an uncanny ability to communicate with players and get them to play on his terms without, you know, laying the hammer down, as he used to say. As I progressed, and he suffered a serious eye injury that shortened his officiating career, he became the director of officiating, and he really meant an awful lot to me in his direction, and I would have went through a wall for the man.
We're joined by Kerry Fraser on the sixth edition of Saturday Spotlight. Kerry, you note there that you also were a linesman for a period, or a few games at least, in the American Hockey League. Did that give you a different perspective in terms of the guys that you ended up working with?
Well, it really did. You know, I in that first season in the American Hockey League, John Van Boxmeer, for example, was a first-round draft pick of the Montreal Canadiens, and I had played junior against John the season before. So, you know, we crossed paths again in a different capacity. Instead of dropping gloves and fighting with one another, I was breaking up fights that he might have been involved in. So it was a whole different perspective for me. Once I dropped the hockey stick and put a whistle on my hand, I completely changed my mindset and all of the things that I knew I had to learn. And being able to work with, as a linesman, with a whole series of different referees that were on their way up to the National Hockey League, allowed me the opportunity to see things that they did that I liked and worked, and things that I thought wouldn't work for me based on a number of issues, size being one, and trying to command respect and personality. So being able to observe how different officials, referees worked and their success rate was inspiring.
You talk about dropping the stick, and you were known as a great skater, and I think officials generally, their skating abilities is underappreciated. How was that transition for you, Kerry? Because I know when I play hockey and I don't have a stick for a while, it's kind of awkward and weird. Was that a natural transition for you? Did that take some time?
I got to tell you, Richard, funny story. When we skate with the stick, we generally tend to swing the stick across our body. You take the stick out of my hand, and I still skated in the same way. And I used to have, I got to admit that I'm certainly a type A personality. I had the little man syndrome. I played tough and played bigger than I was, and was never one to be intimidated as a player. And I took that edge and that attitude onto the ice as a referee, and it didn't serve me well in the early going. But I had players that mocked me when I would give them a penalty, and they would sort of emulate a monkey that had his arms and would make sounds in front of me, and of course I assessed misconduct penalties. I got an opportunity to see myself on a news clip, the sports news one night, and I looked, and visually I had the opportunity to see their perception, which was that I was skating like a monkey. So I quickly changed my arm swing from across my body to more like a runner, which was front to back.
That's very funny. And Kerry, I believe you refereed your first NHL game in 1980, and if my facts are correct, that was a Colorado Rockies Minnesota North Stars game. If that is correct, what do you remember most about that game?
Well, I remember that the new rule came out that year that they wanted to prevent brawling, so that any time a fight broke out, historically players would pair off, drop their gloves, grab a dance partner, and it could end up in a line brawl. So to eliminate that, the new rule was that when a fight broke out, players were instructed to go to their respective benches. Anybody that dropped their gloves and paired off would be instantly assessed a misconduct. Well, in that particular game, we had fights very quickly, and players, it was the third game of the season, and they hadn't quite gotten on to the new rule yet. They all dropped their gloves. They all paired off in the two fights we had. So I had them sitting two and three deep in the penalty box. Of course, the coaches, Glenn Sonmore was coaching the Minnesota North Stars, and he thought that this young referee was just ruining the game. So it was a rough and rocky start for me with the Colorado Rockies playing the Minnesota North Stars. And as we were leaving the building, the fans, of course, were throwing things on the ice, and they hadn't gotten onto the new rule yet either. And as we left the McNichols Arena, the linesman and I, fans were throwing things down over the top of the fence that covered where the bus would pull out. Mm-hmm. And it was quite an experience for my first game.
Did that leave you skeptical, scared? What were your emotions after that?
Well, again, that little man syndrome and that edge that I had, the cocky confidence, I guess, really didn't inhibit me from wanting more. It was my first game. It was exciting. It was a dream come true to be able to do that first game. And it's funny, as we were passing the Minnesota North Star bus, Glenn Sharpley, one of the Minnesota North Star players, as he saw the fans throwing things and shouting at us, said to my linesman, Jim Christensen, he said, "Hey, Chris, if you guys need some help," he said, "you know, we're here for you." Jim Christensen, deadpan, looked at him and said, "Sharp, I've seen you fight. I think we're better off without you."
We're joined by Kerry Fraser on the sixth edition of Saturday Spotlight. Kerry, during the time that you were, you know, a referee in the National Hockey League for some 30 years, you know, I grew up in the mid-'80s or early 90s kind of going to the games at the Winnipeg Arena, and I remember names of the officials in the back of the jerseys, and I could name, you know, Carey Fraser, Van Massenhoven, Terry Gregson. I could go on and on and on, and for whatever reason, that was changed during the time that you were an official, Bill McCreary. I could keep going. Were you in favor of that change?
Not really. I think that part of the success that I enjoyed was the ability to communicate with players and develop a relationship. In any business, anyone that's successful must develop relationships within that business, and it's no different as a referee. You have to earn the respect of the players, and to do so, you have to communicate. I think once the names were removed off the sweaters, which was following our strike in 1994-93, there was sort of an anonymity of the new guys that came in. They still remembered, you know, Koharski and Fraser and Gregson and McCreary and some others, but the new referees were just a number. And I remember Shane Doan, captain in Phoenix, came up to me one game before I dropped the first puck to start the game. And he said, "Carey, what's the name? What's your partner's name? His first name?" He said, "I don't know him, and I like to call the guys by their first name when I communicate with them." So that number prevented Shane Doan from knowing actually who the official or other referee was.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we attend the games in Winnipeg here, Carey, Mick Magoo is in the press box quite often, and just from the, you know, the name on the back of the jersey and seeing him when I was growing up, I don't need to even see, you know, there's no number, you know who he is. It's that recognition that doesn't exist anymore.
And you also know his personality. I mean, Mick was the guy that when he signaled a goal, he just about threw his arm out of the socket with rapid multiple points into the net. So there was a distinguishing factor that and part of their personality that each guy had, and really were part of the game, and fans could identify with the individual officials as much as the players.
Absolutely could. Did you ever receive any threats when you were an official?
Oh, my gosh, I had a couple of death threats. The one that I wrote about in my book, The Final Call, occurred in the Western Conference Final between St. Louis Blues and Calgary Flames. It was Game 6 in 1986. Jacques Demers was coaching the Blues, and they had to win that game to force a Game 7. Rick Walmsley was playing goal for the Blues, and Rob Ramage was the captain. And toward the end of the second period, the Blues were down 3-0, and it looked like the series was over. The Blues had given up. They were taking penalties. Rob Ramage took an aggressive foul by slashing a player, and I put him in the box just before the end of the second period. And as the period ended, I went right to Ramage, and I read him the riot act. I said, "Listen, you get in there and you tell Jacques Demers that if you guys don't get some discipline, I'm going to fill this penalty box. It's going to be game over, series over, you're done." As he left, two giant policemen jumped out of the penalty box in uniform. They grabbed me and said, "Hurry up, Carey, get off the ice." And they took me around by the boards, close to the glass, as opposed to straight on an angle to the Zamboni entrance where we went off in the old St. Louis Arena. We got into the dressing room. One officer said, "Mr. Fraser, it's our duty to inform you that you have received a death threat." I said, "Wow. Well, it's happened before. I'm sure it's some guy sitting at home, and you know, he's watching on TV, and he's disappointed his team's losing, and rather than throw his Budweiser can through the TV, he's made a phone call and said he's going to kill me, right?" And the officers said, "No, that wasn't the case. We traced the call. It came from within the St. Louis Arena from a payphone. The man is here. He said he has a gun, and if you come out for the third period, he's going to shoot you." Well, that was gut check time, Richard, I got to tell you.
Yeah.
I looked across at the two linesmen, Ray Scampanello and Ron Finn, and their eyes were like saucers. And I let the air escape from me, and I said, "Well, sir," I said, "I'm going out for the third period, so he better be a good shot or I better be a fast skater." And wow. As they posted outside the door, and as I was walking down the ramp, the tunnel in the old St. Louis Arena, there was a covering over it that they retracted, and I just about got to the ice, and I turned around to see where the linesmen were, and I assumed they were coming right behind me, and they were 40 feet up the ramp with their skates crossed and their arms folded in front of them. And I waved them to come with, you know, come on, guys, let's go. And they both waved their hands back at me, no, you go, you go. And I went out all on my own, did one lap as quick in a zigzag course as fast as my little feet would carry me. There was no gunshot heard by the two linesmen, and they came out after that.
That is quite a story, Kerry. I wanted to ask you also, but it really is quite a story. I wanted to ask you about players. You know, you see a lot, of course. I think you've actually probably saw it more, you know, years ago than you do now. Which players, and maybe the best players, worked you over the most?
Well, you know, that when I first started, the veterans really tested me. I saw Eddie Shack when I was a rookie referee, and Shacky was quite a character. But they were so big. I mean, everybody looked big to me. I was 5'7", you know, 150 pounds, and these guys were monsters. And I just felt that, you know, I had a job to do. I tried to do it to the best of my ability. And my objective really was to try and enhance the game, to be the best that I could be, but to have a positive effect on a game and not a negative one. Sometimes that wasn't always possible, but, you know, I saw the greatest players, some of the greatest players that the game has known as rookies. You know, I came in with Gretzky and Messier and Coffey and Glenn Anderson, that whole Edmonton team where so many of them, Grant Fuhrer, that all went on to become Hockey Hall of Fame members. Mario Lemieux as a rookie, and then Sidney Crosby that took over from Mario as the franchise in Pittsburgh. And saved it once again. So, you know, from Ovechkin to you name it, it was really a thrill for me. Toronto Maple Leafs, you had, you know, Wendell Clark as a captain, and Rick Vive, I was on the ice when he scored his 50th goal for the first time. Dale Hawerchuk in Winnipeg, I mean, Timo Solani. Seeing these guys in their rookie season, And I was a veteran at that point, but I just knew that they were special. I could see the specialness of those players and knew that they were going to be great players and potential Hockey Hall of Fame members.
When the NHL decided, Kerry, to move from a one-referee system to a two-referee system, what was your initial reaction, and what are your thoughts on it today?
Well, I thought it was good because as part of the NHL Official Association executive, it created more jobs for more people, and that was a good thing. I also felt that the game was speeding up. There were things that had to be extricated from it, particularly the obstruction and the holding and restraining that the league tried for a long time to get rid of. And the game was getting to be almost too fast for one guy that chased it. In 1998, Richard, I went to Nagano to referee the Olympics. Mm-hmm. For the first time that they allowed the professional players and officials to do so. And in the IIHF rules, there was no red line, which the NHL ultimately now has adopted. But you had to chase the puck from the goal line and a stretch pass to the far blue line. And it's humanly impossible for anybody, as good a skater as they might be, to catch that play. So you had to rely on an awful lot of long-distance calls and the assistance of your linesman to cover on those stretch passes for plays and goals at the net. The game sort of dictated that as it moved along at a faster pace and removing the red line and to get rid of the bad elements that needed to be taken out of it, it was really important to have a second set of eyes on the ice, viewing it from a different perspective. From a broadcast perspective, if you look at it, I always liken it to trying with one referee to televise a game with one camera angle following the play. If you take that second look from the front end, it's usually a better look on infractions. You have a front view. So it really was an important advantage to have two referees on the ice.
Joined by Kerry Fraser, former NHL official and analyst with TSN on the Saturday Spotlight on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Kerry, did the NHL ever tell you to call a game a certain way based on what had happened in past games, or was that always your prerogative to call the game as you saw fit?
Well, there was direction given. There were times where I was put into games, reassigned to games, following an incident that might have happened in a back-to-back situation. I remember the Toronto Maple Leafs and Ottawa Senators had a big brawl in Toronto. I was, instead of going to being assigned to Colorado, I was sent into Ottawa for the grudge match, the return match, two nights later. Bill McCreary was the other referee. He had been assigned to that game, but I was moved in to work with him. And within 5 minutes, we had a couple of penalties. We gave them the icy stare right off the bat, and we had the meeting out of our hands. They just played after the sort of laid the hammer down right off the bat. There was other situations where, you know, you just, you were put in there to do the job because of something that, that happened previously in a maybe an injury or a nasty event.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you another thing about treatment of star players, Kerry, from your perspective. Because I was watching the game the other night. The Pittsburgh Penguins were in town in Winnipeg. It's a great game, and you watch a guy like Evander Kane, and he's running around the ice, and he's playing a physical brand of hockey. But when he got around Sidney Crosby, he never gave him the extra push. He never gave him the extra cross-check. And we hear a lot about, you know, referees and the NHL wanting to protect its stars. Do you think part of it is also the respect from the players for the star players and their maybe lack of willingness to physically, you know, impose themselves upon those guys?
Well, that's a very valid point, Richard. The respect element is crucial. I see a lack of respect that players demonstrate to one another during this era of the game, mm-hmm. That we didn't see before, even in the rough and tumble 70s, 80s, and early 90s. That element of respect from player to player has to come in. Wayne Gretzky, for example, was a guy that could really make you look foolish easily, so players played off him a little bit. They didn't want to commit or overcommit. And, of course, during that era, we had guys like Dave Semenko and Marty McSorley that would take care of business if they felt there was a little bit too much rough stuff going at star players. But it is very true that players like Gretzky, like Sidney Crosby, deserve the respect that they get, but that's not to say that they're not played hard. Sidney Crosby is an aggressive player, mm-hmm. and he's very intense. He plays the game the way it should be at both ends of the ice, albeit with an awful lot of skill. So Alexander Ovechkin is another guy that is a rough customer. I mean, he can really hit, and he doesn't give an inch, and oftentimes players reciprocate with some aggressive play towards him.
I wanted to ask you about respect, and you got to it kind of. Why do you think, Kerry, there isn't that, and I agree with you, the same respect player to player that there was in the past? And I wonder even more so because you see how tight the PA seems to be in these battles and, you know, NHLPA negotiations, and, you know, beforehand they maybe weren't as close in that respect, but yet you get on the ice and it seems like it's a whole different ballgame.
Well, Richard, those early years when it was very physical and aggressive and we had line brawls and bench clearings, there were times where a player would be going to hit a guy that was vulnerable against the boards, and I would hear him say, "Heads up, I'm coming," and he would either wrap him, give him the little bit of a bear hug to ease the momentum into the boards, or just take a piece off to the side a little bit. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't run him directly in from behind and hit the numbers. And it's interesting that there are certain players. Montreal Canadiens were a very respected organization, and anyone that came into that dressing room was taught by veterans about respect from Sir Savard, Larry Robinson. It was all passed down. And I remember a rookie player, first-round pick, that came in and was very proud. He was a French-Canadian. He was drafted by the Montreal Canadiens in the first round, took his sweater off, and threw it in the hamper after the first practice. And Larry Robinson walked over to the hamper. He pulled the sweater out. He looked at the player and turned the sweater over and said, "The crest is first. The name on the back is second." And he flipped the reversed the order of the way that the sweater went into the hamper.
That's a great story. And Kerry, you mentioned, we're joined by Kerry Fraser on the Saturday Spotlight, you mentioned refereeing in the 98 Olympics. I wanted to ask you about that. When you called the games in the Olympics, did you call them differently? Because, you know, we always see the hockey on the IIHF level is maybe called differently than the National Hockey League. Did you call it at all differently, not from with an edict from above, as much as maybe you saw it was a different game and you thought you had to call it differently, or did you call it the same as you would have a National Hockey League game?
Well, the game was different because the ice surface was wider. You know, you take 100-foot width of ice, 15 feet wider than a National League building, and all of the players pretty much were NHL players. So they were familiar with me, and I was familiar with them. It was also a tournament as opposed to a regular season kind of game, mm-hmm. Or even a playoff game. It was heightened because this tournament was everybody returning to their country and playing for their flag and their country. It was very intense. But the fact that the ice was wider, bigger ice surface, created less body contact. So players had to adjust. They had to play off somebody. They couldn't overcommit to making a check because by the time they got to that guy, the puck was already moving and it was gone, and they had to be chasing. It was more of a puck-chasing game as opposed to that physical dominance that one team could have over another.
Your last NHL game, Kerry, if I'm correct, was the New York Rangers against the Philadelphia Flyers. It was a shootout. It ended the last game of the season. It was a shootout, and I believe that was the year the Flyers went to the Stanley Cup final. And I believe Olli Jokinen, if I recall, and I'll ask you because you would recall better than I did, missed on the last opportunity for the Rangers, sending the Flyers to the playoffs. What were your emotions that day?
Well, it was an amazing day for me. The night before, we had a gathering at my house with the officials that were working the game with me. My family came from Canada, family members, so it was, you know, the very emotional. It was a Sunday, I went to Mass alone early. It was an afternoon game. As I was driving into the arena, I received a text message from Wayne Gretzky congratulating me on a great career, and that was surreal. And very humbling. As I walked into the arena in Philadelphia, the New York Rangers were playing, as you mentioned, and Mark Messier stopped by the dressing room as I was walking in to wish me well and congratulate me again on my career. I had a great relationship with both of those individuals, as I did with many others, knowing the importance of that game, Richard, as I talked to my fellow officials the night before at our gathering at my home and said, guys, this is the season for both of these teams. It all comes down to this game. They're tied for that last playoff spot in the East, and whoever wins goes on. Who doesn't win goes home and plays golf. So I said, we need to be the very best we can be. The game is about them. It's not about me. It's not about us. And I'm really proud of the way that our crew worked that game. It did go into the shootout, and of course, Olli Jokinen missed on that last shot. Brian Boucher was the goalie for the Philadelphia Flyers that made the save. Henrik Lundqvist was the other goalie at the other end. He stopped 50-some shots in that game. He was amazing, and it almost looked like in the overtime that John Tortorella had his players ragging the puck to kill the clock towards the end of that overtime, waiting to get into the shootout and pitting their guy, Henrik Lundqvist, against Brian Boucher. It backfired.
Yeah, it did. And, you know, Kerry, when I listened to you break down the game, I watched Wayne Gretzky this past Saturday, and they were showing, I guess, it was a clip from, it was a picture or something, and Wayne Gretzky started citing exactly what happened in the game where the picture was taken. And it seems like, I know from obviously you're an official as opposed to a player, but you are able to recall games and moments pretty vividly. Is that a trait you've always had?
Well, it really is. I have a terrific memory. But one of the wonderful things, the gifts that I have or was given, is the ability to recall the emotion of the incident as well. And that's really how the book came about. I knew as early as 1985, when I worked my first Stanley Cup final, that there was going to be someday I would like to write a book. And it was spawned from post games, where I would go into a restaurant or a bar after a game with my colleagues, and I would see stares from people, and they obviously were recognizing mm-hmm. us and me. And sometimes those stares were stern glares. And I would walk over, introduce myself, and I'd ask the fan if they had a question for me. And sometimes it was aggressive. They would say, yeah, I got a question for you. What did you miss that call? Blah, blah, blah. And I would answer their question respectfully. And then one question led to another question to another. And I found out what they really wanted, Richard, was to find out what it was like on the other side of the glass. They want their ticket got them in to as close as row one, but they could never get beyond that glass. And that's what the stories and the events and the incidents are able to share with fans and bring them into our world on the ice.
Again, Gary, this is great stuff. When you were an official for 30 years, we mentioned 1980 to 2010. We're joined by Kerry Fraser on the Saturday Spotlight. What changed the most about the game throughout those 30 years?
Well, you know, each decade there was almost a change in the game, the evolutionary process of the game. We went from the brawling of the 70s and or into the early 80s. There were times where it was almost vital for the league to impose new rules. The courts, law of the land, was starting to get involved. Attorney General Roy McMurtry in Ontario was charging players with assault. So we also lost an NBC television contract in 79-80 as a result of games that were taking 3 hours to play with all the brawling that was going on. So there were need to change in that regard. Then we went to the stick swinging incidents, and that had to be extricated. We started with major penalties, whether players they had to be responsible for their sticks, and whether it was accidental or careless or whatever, they were imposed a major and a game misconduct. Well, that only lasted a year, and it was dialed back to double minors. But the stick work sort of took care of itself with that adherence to the rule. And then, of course, finally we had to get rid of that obstruction, the restraining mm-hmm. that took place for so many years. And that took a long time, because often when the general managers and rules committee sit around the meetings in the summertime, they don't think that it's going to be called against them. It's pretty easy to say, we want this changed. But as soon as the referees start laying the hammer down to get the players to play a certain way at the start of the season, it can quickly change. And it turns out that there's only a 29-team league instead of 30, because one team is always saying it doesn't apply to them.
Kerry, are you in favor of the coach's challenge?
Oh, I really am. I think the game has evolved to such a point where goals are being manufactured illegally with contact in the crease. The game is very fast. I think the referees can be better in the two-referee system. I think they need better coaching techniques. We see too many games that are decided with dirty goals. And, you know, last year, late in the season, there was L.A. was playing in Detroit, and a puck was deflected up off the mm-hmm. netting that ricocheted off the netting, came down, and went off Jonathan Quick's back and into the goal. That was the tying goal with a couple of seconds left, and Detroit ended up winning the game in overtime. And the L.A. Kings were desperate for points at that point in the season. So we need to have a coach's challenge where unusual events happen that result in goals.
Kerry, what do you think of the ref cam?
I really like it. I think it, it takes that fan onto the ice and gives them the perspective that the referee has. It's not to say that his eyes are looking exactly where his helmet is, mm-hmm. but nonetheless, it gives them that close, great camera shot, especially in and around the action. They get to see what he could be looking at and probably is. It also is a great teaching tool for young referees, because they need to be more aware. Watching Wayne Gretzky, for example, and Mario Lemieux and others, they had such great vision of the ice. They knew not just where the puck was now or where players were in the moment. They knew where they were going to be 2, 3, 4 chess moves down the board. And that's what a referee has to do. He has to have an uncanny sense of vision of the ice so that he's not a puck watcher. And I think if the helmet cam is dialed in following the puck all the time, then that official is not picking up the things that he really needs to in advance of a play.
Kerry, how did you get your start in television and writing for TSN.ca?
So once I retired and I was promoting my book, The Final Call, that I had written immediately after leaving the ice, I was in the province of Quebec. And I spent a week there, and I went on RDS, the L'Entrechamp show, with Mario Tremblay and Michel Bergeron. It was a half-hour talk show in French, and I was, of course, speaking in English, and it was being translated. But I had a great time poking fun at both guys, but particularly Michel Bergeron, who we had I had quite a history with. And after I got home from Quebec, 2 days later, I received a call from Steve Dryden at TSN, and he asked me if I was available and if I was interested. They were doing launching That's Hockey Tonight, which Steve Koulias hosts, and they wanted to create a segment for me. Well, that's how Come On Ref was spawned. And what was interesting is people loved it because they got the perspective, like Mike Pereira with the NFL, where they got to hear from the inside a guy that's been there, done that, and gave them the straight talk, straight goods. Well, when we started the column, which expanded the on-air segments, it allowed more people to be involved. And the blog is a great thing because the fans would be able to give their input. And when we first started, there was a lot of hostility. A lot of people really didn't like Carey Fraser, the referee, and they made their point in the blogs. But I just stayed the course and tried to develop relationships with fans in this blog and in my approach to the columns, like I would on the ice with players. And the tide quickly turned. There was a great education that I saw fans getting. They had a different perspective and take from an official's perspective. They got to see that they're human, they make mistakes, and I operated the column on three basic premises. One, I have to be totally honest. It is what it is. Number two, I had to be fair, fair to the officials, to give their perspective, even though they may have missed the call, what it is they were looking at, which was all part of the education for the fan. And three, to have an opinion. I couldn't sit on the fence. I had to be like I was on the ice, make the call. Sometimes it's a tough one. So we've really seen a great interest in Come On Ref on TSN and a great education that the fans have been getting, and we're learning as we go.
Well, I think it's, Carey, I can attest, I think that's 100% true. I know when I watch NFL games, it's almost as if you wait then for Mike Pereira or Mike Carey, whoever it is, to come in and tell you if that was the correct call. And when something happens in the National Hockey League, I go to the blog to take a look and see what you have to say, because frankly, you know, we're not experts, and then you're a refereeing expert, and you, and as you mentioned, you come on at it in an honest fashion. You know you're going to get the breakdown of exactly what happened.
Well, the other thing that's interesting too, Richard, is I was traveling with Theo Fleury and some other retired hockey players. We were doing charity events in Western Canada, and as we're driving down the road in the bus, Theo said, "Hey, are you on Twitter?" And I said, "Twitter? What's that?" I mean, I'm 60 years old, Theo. What the heck's Twitter? He said, "Oh, you got to get on Twitter." So he grabbed my iPhone, and the next thing I know, he said, "What handle do you want?" And I said, "Well, at K Fraser the call sounds pretty good to me." He says, "Okay, that's you." And he set me up on Twitter. Well, there's 25,000 people that follow me every night with hockey games going on, and the nice thing is that I engage them. If they have a question about a game, I go on NHL Game Center Live, I look at the play, they give me the time it happens, and I answer their questions. So it's certainly valuable in the playoffs. As I'm working at TSN, I am able to tweet things out in the moment. And that's what fans want to know. They want to know now, what was that call? Was it right? Was it wrong? Or was it indifferent?
And don't blame us, Carey, if after this interview you get 13,000 tweets about the Winnipeg Jets and a bad call.
Well, we get an awful lot of information coming our way from Winnipeg Jet fans. Believe me, they're great fans. And I got to tell you, Richard, I am so happy that Winnipeg is back in the NHL. They never should have left. I get the smaller market, and it was time. But look at the wonderful fan following that the Winnipeg Jets have had, and not just currently, but when they moved to Phoenix. Those Jet fans never left.
You're absolutely right. Final question for you, Carey, and really appreciate you giving of your time today. It's been an extended interview, and I could talk to you for 3 hours probably. What role, in researching, you know, your career, you read a lot about your dad and his role in your life. What role has family had in terms of your career and your life?
Oh, my gosh, Richard. I must tell you that when I looked in the mirror after my last game, and I was the last one out of the dressing room, and I looked in that mirror, and I I tried to figure out who I was. Who is Cary Fraser? What is Cary Fraser? Is he the guy known with the great hair? Is he the guy that's been the referee and the personality for 30 years in the NHL? And then when I walked up the hall to a reception, and I walked through the door, and I saw my wife, my children, seven children, and our grandchildren running towards me with 100 people in the room, I knew right then and there that's what Cary Fraser is all about. It's his family that made him the person that he is.
That's great stuff, Cary. Cary Fraser is a former NHL official. Everybody knows that. TSN analyst, writer of Come On Ref, author of The Final Call. Thank you so much for joining us on the sixth edition of Saturday Spotlight.
Richard, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The O'Legal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch The O'Legal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN1290.ca.